Welcome to the JOMA podcast, presented by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. Every week, hear from expert medical professionals as they share up-to-date insights on health topics to help you live your best life physically, mentally, and emotionally. Join us as we navigate the ever-changing landscape of healthcare and strive to improve the health of the Orthodox Jewish community.
Welcome to the JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jenny Berkovich, board-certified pediatrician and director of education for JOMA. This episode about trauma therapy was so interesting with Mindy Blumfield. Mindy is a licensed clinical social worker, a writer, speaker, and therapist who connects with thousands of people through her work when not holed up in her office therapizing, writing, training, or lecturing. Mindy is tending to her other loves, family, travel, biking, and yoga. I hope you guys enjoy this episode as much as I did. Hi, Mindy. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I spent the last probably like 2 weeks sort of perusing your website and learning about you and all your wonderful work. So I'm really excited to hear a little bit more about that. To start off with, I guess, tell us a little bit about your therapist. So like, tell us about your personal journey. How did you, become a therapist? What inspired you to become a therapist, specifically one that focuses on trauma therapy?
Okay. So the truth is, I don't think I ever wasn't a therapist. It's like, you know, like one of those kids who like, I always listen to everyone else's problems. And so I think I was one of those kids. And it was just kind of like, I was a teacher first. I was a doula. I was a Kala teacher. There were so many things that I did along the road. And then it came to a certain point that like, I wanted more. And honestly, there was Touro College opened an all-female cohort in Flatbush. And I said, you know, I need to do this. And the first day that I walked into class, it was like just coming home. So it was really an amazing. And I'll tell you the truth is, I don't think it's possible to do therapy today without being a trauma therapist. So I know there are trauma-informed therapists, but no, you really need to be trained in trauma work itself because everything really comes back to trauma eventually. So that's just part of what I did. Become a trauma therapist and do all the training, constant training in order to be a trauma therapist.
What's the difference between a trauma therapist and a trauma-informed therapist?
I would say that a trauma therapist is someone that actually is trained in trauma work. There are specific modalities, evidence-based, research-based, let's say EMDR, somatic work, now IFS. There's actual modalities that have evidence-based, there are trauma modalities. And then trauma-informed is just like, you know, having experience or just, getting in touch with it, doing supervision. But, you know, being trauma-trained is very different than trauma-informed. It's specifically the training that we have to do trauma work.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that probably leads into maybe what triggered you to write some of the things that you've written about. I know you have a few books out, and most recently you wrote a book, focusing primarily on helping children navigate hospitalizations or helping caregivers, right, navigate a children's a hospitalization experience. Tell me a little bit about that and the motivation to write about that type of topic.
Okay, so actually I will just show it to you. It's an actual children's book.
It's a children's book. It's beautiful. It's beautiful, yeah. By the way.
It's unbelievable. Honestly, like I'm so excited about it. So it's a children's book. It's really for children with any kind of challenges at all. But what happened was, is that I had a child, and when he was 6 years old, he was diagnosed with cancer. He went into remission 6 weeks later. He did his surgery. He did rehab. He was in RUSC. He had chemotherapy. He went into remission. He went into remission like 3 months later. Okay. He did his radiation treatment. He had rehabilitation because he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't move some of his limbs. And then, you know, we did that. And then he went into remission. Okay. So what happened was, is that when he went into remission, I actually went back to the emergency room, back to the hospital, back to all the places that we had gone to do all our things. And I had taken pictures And we did pictures together. And also even when he was in the hospital and at Rusk at rehabilitation, we took pictures over there and we did all kinds of fun things. And then I put it into a book and I created a text in order to help him process his journey. He, you know, I was a therapist at that point, and I just created that this entire book in order to let him kind of like go through his journey in a way that helped him process, you know, what that journey was for him. Because again, it was a lot of different pieces of it. It was the radiation treatment. It was physical therapy. It was speech therapy. It was his fears about going back to school. There were so many different aspects of it. And that was it. And he literally read that book, I think, for, you know, over and over again. He took it out on the anniversary of his surgery every year. He showed it to his friends. His grandmother had a copy of it that whoever came into the house kind of like looked at it. So it was like just part of our life, his journey. And then what happened was is that he actually did not make it. He did relapse when he was 11 years old, and he didn't make it. And when he was 16, he actually died. And interestingly enough, you know, my mother says, if I hear another word of how beautiful the day of his death was, I'm going to kill you. But again, but it was he was at home when he died. It was very, very calm. He was very calm and we were very calm. It was a very beautiful, organic experience of just being with him in the quiet of the stillness of the morning and just allowing him to pass on. And afterwards, you know, a few years later, I found his journal again. And I said, you know something, there was something about this whole journey with him. It was 10 years that he was sick. And there was something so beautiful about the entire journey that somehow there wasn't the drama around it. There wasn't the panic, the hysteria. Of course, we had our moments. Of course we did. But it wasn't like this like ongoing hysteria. It was really a very calm 10 years, which culminated really like in his very calm death, in which he was calm about his death. He was really in a good place. And I wanted in some way to be able to share that with other parents and their children going through this. So I took the journal and I found a illustrator, Mark Loomer, who is the most amazing children's illustrator. And what I loved about Mark's illustrations is that if you notice, they're colorful, they're whimsical. It's like the lightheartedness, the fun lovingness. It just, there's nothing dreary or scary about it. And I said, you know, Mark, can you do something with it? And he said, you know, this is a book about cancer. And I said, no, it's not. It's a book about life. It's a book about just about a challenge and how the strength of every child to overcome challenges. So he did. So together we co-wrote this book, and it was based on actually what happened was that my son got sick. I didn't know he was sick then, but I always used to read him books and stories, and he wasn't in the mood of looking at pictures. I guess at that point it was a brain tumor. He actually couldn't focus on pictures. So I don't know like what happened. It just like kind of like leaped into my head, these like fully formed quadruplets, Hilly, Pilly, Shimmy, and Shmaya. And I just started telling him stories about them, and he simply found them hilarious. And when Mark took my journal, he said, tell me about these quadruplets. He goes, that's our story. So in this story, you have about a kid who gets sick and he's afraid to go into the MRI or into the radiation alone. And his parents say, we can't come in with you. Even though actually in the MRIs today, MRIs, parents could come in with their children, but CAT scans, they still don't let parents inside. So there are just different treatments in which children really have to do it alone. So in the book, the mother says, you know, I have an idea of who will come into the room with you, who could be flat and still with you by the machine. And she goes, here are Hilly, Pilly, Shimmy, and Shmaya. And then his imagination takes over and they come alive for him, and they help him to overcome those feelings of sad, mad, and scared, which become also personified characters in the book. So it's like a really, like it's really like a, just like a very like whimsical, fun loving, creative, imaginative book with a touch of fantasy that we created in order that parents and children should be able to undergo. Again, it's about, you know, for those who are obviously undergoing a medical crisis, but really children with any kind of challenges, because it addresses so many children's fears in there, going back to school, looking funny, not being able to hear properly. How am I going to learn? What are the kids going to say about my scars? Like all those different things that just kids worry about in all different capacities. So, yeah.
I mean, that's a very, very inspiring story. I'm really touched by the strength that you were able to draw from your personal experience to be able to like contribute something to, you know, the community and families who may be experiencing something similar. My instinct is like as a general pediatrician, right? So I've taken care of kids who have, you know, received a diagnosis of any chronic medical issue. Yeah. And I could see families and even parents being like, okay, I get it. Like, it's important to process these things. But when you're going through it, like, I just can't, right? I just can't go back to the ER extra time. Like, why people still, even after they've maybe recovered from an illness, find it very traumatic and even triggering to go near a hospital, in a hospital, right? The smells and the sounds and all of it just bring them back to the experiences they were having. So how, at any recommendations, I guess, both for to me as a pediatrician and maybe also to families who have that instinct to say, like, I know it's important, but I'm not at a place where I can go back and like start processing these things in a healthy way.
Okay, thank you for that question. It's such a great question. So here is really what I want to tell parents, okay? Children see the world through their parents' eyes. A child is only as afraid as their mother or father is. And I'm sure as a pediatrician, you see that. When you have calm parents, you generally see calm children. And I even remember Dr. Norman Blumenthal, when my son relapsed, and I said, Dr. Blumenthal, I said, how am I going to do this dying thing with him? And you know what he told? I'll never forget what he told me. He said, Mindy, children from good families die well. And it was like, oh, does that mean that whatever I can do, if I can do this well, then he'll do it well. And that's what he was saying. And I think that what parents need to know is that however they're going to see whatever's going on, if a diagnosis of diabetes becomes a point of hysteria, then that kid will absorb that. If diabetes is simply something that we're going to deal with like anything else, that's what it'll be. So that happens with everything. It happens with a child who has a learning disability, yeah. A child who has a scar on their face, a scar that has a child that has the ink, like what are those, like the quartz stains on their face. It happens however a parent will approach it. So really what I would tell parents in general, I guess you're seeing the parents sometimes even before their tragedy. Yeah. I would really encourage the pediatricians and doctors who see parents before any kind of tragedy, when they see a parent that's really not regulated in their life. You know, those panicky parents who come in, yeah. Just if you can open up the idea that therapy for them might help them to clean out whatever they've been dealing with in their past, that doesn't allow that openness, that they can embrace their life in all of its gray areas in a way that can be helpful to them, that when things do happen, they are in a more regulated place to be able to accept it. And then the second thing is that when a parent is already getting a diagnosis and they are not regulated, is really to encourage them to go to therapy and to say, of course you can't do this on your own. Of course not. Who's expecting a parent on their own to just go to just like have a child with cancer or diabetes or anything or missing a finger at birth and just say, oh, like I'm just able to manage it. Like, no. I mean, I'll tell you the honest truth is that when I got the diagnosis, I don't know how I found it, but I ended up on a support group, an online support group of other parents who had children with pediatric brain tumors. I want to tell you, I was on it from 5 to 8 every single morning for almost a year. So even after he was in remission, I was there. That was how I cope with it. So there's support groups, there's support online, there's therapy. There's so many ways in which to process and in which to manage and to be supported in the place that you are. And it's great to have a wonderful marriage, which I do. And it's great to have wonderful siblings and parents, which I do as well, and friends and also that. But there's something about doing whatever you need in order to get support. So if a good marriage is enough, great. If you need also parents, siblings. And I'll tell you the honest truth, I would also recommend that parents avail themselves of all resources. I want to tell you, that organization, Chesed, that gave me rides back and forth to the hospital, they saved my sanity. You know, first of all, the expense of parking at that point. And even for those people who don't have to worry about the expense, there's also just the aspect of there that you call someone up and they just take care of it. You don't need to think about the ride and about finding parking, about taking your kid and going in front of the hospital and taking him in the wheelchair and out of the wheelchair. It's like literally. So I would recommend so many different things of how parents can cope with what they need. And lastly, what I will tell you as the pediatrician is that for you to be aware that even though you're wondering, like, you know, parents say, oh, I can't do that. Very often the parents that can't are the ones who have their own prior history of trauma. So I'm telling this to you. So really, those parents need to go into therapy even more than anyone else, more than the support groups, because they have to deal with their own stuff of whatever's making them not be able to handle it. Their own history of anxiety, their own history of feeling like a failure, own history of feeling abandoned by Hashem or anything like that. So just you to be aware, doctors should be aware of that, because the parents who really have who are healthy, then they really can. They find a way in their way to deal with their child and what they need to do. And And I guess there's also another piece that it's really important for parents to be open with the children, that on the level of a kid understanding what's happening to them, they really need to be open with them. So when they don't need to keep secrets from their child and secrets from their mother and grandmother and mother-in-law and everyone else, it becomes much easier to handle things. So a lot of the trauma that happens is not so much the actual cancer or the actual diagnosis, it's all the stuff around it.
So I'm curious what your take on this is, because that is something that I've seen many, many, many times, both with, you know, really devastating diagnoses such as a malignancy, or even, you know, less impactful ones, but still a diagnosis that the family, and like we'll even have this on the chart, right? Like, don't discuss the diagnosis in front of the child. ADHD is a really common one. Learning disabilities is a common one where, like, yeah, all over the chart, it'll say like, talk to family privately, right, about the diagnosis, which I never really support as a pediatrician. I always want to make sure there's shared decision making. And I love the idea of talking to kids on their level. But how do you approach that? Like, how is it good? Because I understand as a parent wanting to shield your child from certain things and from potential stigmas or other things that may feel really stressful to them, especially if you don't have the tools to have that conversation at their level.
Yeah, so I think I will be forever grateful to Dr. Jeffrey Ristoff, who is my son's neurosurgeon. And he comes into the hospital, and he comes, it's the first time I've ever been in a hospital. And this is actually before I'm even a therapist, okay? I became a therapist at 38. And this was like just that year of my first year of schooling. And he walks in, he says, do you know why you're here? And my son says, like, he barely can talk. And he says, well, you have a brain tumor inside your head. And I'm thinking to myself, no, quiet.
Don't tell him, right?
Yeah. And he says, you have a brain tumor. He goes, and I'm the surgeon. I'm a really good surgeon. And I am going to take it out of your head, and you are going to feel much better. And that was it. And I saw now I understand that my son's whole body relaxed. Oh, this is what the problem is. This is what we're going to do. And I'm going to be okay. It was simply like amazing. Now, I guess for every disease and every situation, there's a different kind of okay.
Yeah.
And on their level, what will that okay be? If a kid is missing a finger, it will be okay. You're going to learn to play ball with three fingers instead of five. You have a club foot. We're going to figure out a shoe that you're going to be able to run around the bases. And don't worry, you'll be part of that baseball game. Everything. And again, it's how the parent feels and how the parent takes in the information that gives the message to the kid of how it's going to be. So I'm forever grateful to Dr. Whistle. That's the honest truth.
I like that. I think that's really important, but I do want to emphasize it's not always easy to do, which I think goes back to making sure the family and the adults in that situation have good support systems. They have the resources. They, you know, have a therapist that they can discuss this with to make sure that they can have these conversations in a really meaningful way. I have to say, I never thought about making sure that the family has like, right, specifically therapy. Whenever I'm dealing with a child with a chronic medical condition, I always encourage therapy as like part of that so they can, they themselves, right, can learn to navigate whatever they need to navigate. But I think I've been neglecting the parents. So this, I think, is a really, really good reminder, because they're the ones really steering the environment around the child. Yeah. And that sounds like it really makes all the difference.
I believe that if you have a choice to have the parents in therapy, because like you're saying, because they could do all that support. Because really, yeah. Honestly, I mean, you're a pediatrician and you're so savvy and informed. And I think for the most part, I mean, definitely in New York and, you know, in the place that I've gone to, the hospitals and doctors are really so child friendly. There's the child life specialists. There's so much, the nurses, they're so wonderful. Even the environment of a hospital is like, really, there's like all the games and the toys and the library and the clowns that come. So really, I believe that the children are supported. It's just a question, will the parents be able to allow the children to access all that support?
Yeah, that's true. So I want to talk a little bit about prevention, which maybe seems strange in the context of trauma, right? Like we can't prevent the trauma, but you've mentioned a couple of things that I want to expand on a little bit. What mm-hmm. can we do as parents and caregivers to set up an environment, set up the kind of maybe network, or make sure that we maybe have the tools whenever something does happen? And so the big thing that I always think about are like kind of like bigger traumas, community traumas, you know, school shootings, you know, mass events like that. And I've heard a lot and seen a lot of, I think, you know, studies and evidence to say, what can we do to build resiliency and be able to react appropriately and communicate the things that we need to when these kinds of things happen. But maybe can we talk a little bit about like maybe concrete strategies? What can we do to really make sure from both a mental health standpoint and from a resiliency standpoint, we're doing work in our families should something happen? Because realistically, you know, not everything is going to be great all the time. We know Hashem sends us challenges. So what can we do to like make sure that we have a strong base to build and expand on whenever we need to?
Okay, it's a great question. So I would say a couple of things. And don't forget, I'm talking from a therapeutic perspective, and I'm sure there are other perspectives as well. So first of all, I would tell, you know, any parent that if you have unresolved stuff from your history, it's time to take care of it. Okay? Do it if you can't, if you didn't want to do it for yourself because you didn't, you know, you said, oh, it's too much time or it's too much money or whatever.
Yeah.
Do it for your child. Okay? That's the first thing. When a parent will resolve their stuff, it helps them to create an inner resource that will impact their child's ability to have their inner resources. Children mirror their parents. So, I mean, parents are a mirror for their child. So when a child looks into the parent as a mirror, that will be reflected back into the child. So the healthier a parent is, the healthier the child is. And especially in an attached perspective. If there's a parent who feels that there is in some way that they are not able to attach to any of their children, they really should take care of it. And even though I know that they love their child, there's something that's blocking a relationship with a specific child or with all of their children. Again, therapy is really important because children feel safe from an attached place. There's a lot of research now. You know, as therapists, we always understood the role of attachment in the fact that a child will feel safe, in that client will feel safe in a therapy environment in which they feel attached to a therapist. But you know, we know that Dr. Porges is a very famous scientist and doctor, and he actually has proven scientifically with the polyvagal theory of why we know that for a fact that attachment, a child that is securely attached actually feels safe. There's a direct correlation between safety and attachment. So I actually have over here, a client gave me when she left, and it says, Safety is not the absence of threat. Safety is the presence of connection. And that's really what you need to understand. A baby in Auschwitz, in their mother's arms, felt safe. It didn't matter what the reality was around that baby. If they were in their mother's arms, safely attached, that's where safety is. And from a place of safety, that's where people manage their challenges, from a place of safety. Now, in the same way, you know, in the same way when a child goes to school, right? How does a child have that sense of safety if their mother's not right next to them? Because we understand that there's something called internalizing the object, which means when children from a small age, they feel safe and connected to their parents, then they internalize that feeling of connection and safety, even when the parent is 6,000 miles away. And the older we get, you know, we even had that concept with like Yosef HaTzadik, that he was able to withstand the challenges of Potiphar and in jail, because they said there was the image of his father before him. And that's what it is. When a child has that image of the parent before him, inside of him, they can manage a lot of whatever the challenges come up. So when you ask me about preventive, definitely old stuff is really important. And then, of course, if the marriage is not solid, then that also creates a lack of safety for children. So work on building a marriage. And then there's the piece of like what you can do to build up a child. I mean, no matter how great of parents we are, how perfect our marriages are, and how perfect, you know, the fact is that the children live in an unsettling world, and we can't protect them from all anxiety, from all challenges, and we can't even protect them from any kind of reaction that they're going to have, right? It's not possible, no matter what we do in our own work. And then comes just another piece that I would just recommend, not as a mental health professional, but just as a mother speaking, you know, it means if your child doesn't have that inner strength for whatever reasons they are, things that you're in the middle of working on, things that you can't help him with or her, do things that will build up that child. And that might be things by giving that child specific lessons in what they excel at. If they love baking, if they love art, if they love gymnastics, wherever they can build their strengths. Another thing could be is that whatever their strengths are in the house themselves. You know, when kids get jobs, your child doesn't need to get the job of vacuuming if they literally don't mind holding the baby for 24/7. So build on a child's strengths. You know, make time to speak to a child. You know, like every, you know, depending on how many children you have, try to make a rotation that at least like once a week, like you have 10 minutes to like really concentrated, just time with that kid, that kid could feel that you could talk to them. And then with a teenager, that's not going to work. With a teenager, you would rather wait whenever that teenager seems in the mood of talking, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're just finished cleaning up the house and you're ready for bed. And that's when the teenager's like popping on the couch and like starting to talk. That's it. You give up another hour of your sleep and just sit down and talk at that point. So it's also that kind of like ability just like to open up, because there's nothing as important to a child as a relationship with a parent. So that really is very regulating and helps a child to really manage their challenges that they have outside of the house.
That was really helpful. I thought that was a good list of like very practical examples. That was great. I do want to emphasize like the jobs and the chores as a really key factor of exactly like you said, like building up the child, right? Like getting them into activities and making sure they feel good about themselves. And right, all of that is a key piece. But chores, like we really have actually really good evidence and data to show that kids who grow up with chores, who have a dedicated job, just like you said, in the house, really end up developing a strong sense of responsibility, of a strong sense of contributing to a community. Their first community is their family. And it actually ends up being really impactful. I very recently added as part of my screening questions when I see kids for their checkups, like I ask about safety and wearing a like helmet when they're on their bike and make sure they know how to swim. I added recently a question of, do you have any chores? And especially like from families are like surprised, like, oh, of course I have chores. All right, whatever, I do this. And I'm like, no, but like, tell me exactly what your jobs are in the house. Sometimes mom will ask you to sit the Shabbos table, right? And sometimes you're in charge of holding the baby, but like, what are your jobs in the house? And I find that when they have a dedicated thing, they feel so good about themselves. They know that Shabbos table is not going to get set unless they do it. And that, you know, that feeling, I think, of contribution ends up building up there's a self-esteem and their resiliency, contributing rather to their resiliency to withstand yucky stuff that's probably going to come their way.
Yes. And I would add to that, that as a child grows older, as all of us, we're all guilty, we actually feel better about doing chores out of the house. So we'd rather clean some other person's house as a chesed than
that's
our
so
own.
That's so true. Why is that?
It is. I don't know what the data is about that, but we do. We get a lot, because the truth is when we do something for someone else, we get so much feedback. Oh, what a mitzvah girl. You're so wonderful. So I would also encourage that as children get older and it's no longer enough, simply the parents' accolades of what you're doing right, because children, as children grow, they need to incorporate outside people into their support system. So volunteer work for children as they grow older, I think, is wonderful, like sending them out to their grandmother to help or whatever it is, if a child wants, obviously, not, you know, but to encourage, if a child has an interest in helping others, not to say, oh, you're not helping in the house, but you're going to help your sister. But yeah, if they're helping their married sister with their kids, it gives them a sense of all what you said, and they get all that positive feedback in a way that's easier than in the house.
For sure. I love that. So I want to end with sort of bringing the conversation back to the book, which I think is a really, really important resource. But any, like, if you would say, like, whatever, two, three, like, key takeaways from the book.
So the truth is, first of all, you know, I would say the fact that the child knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, you know, somewhere in the book, the kid says, like, you know, I had a brain tumor. Like, he's very clear. He's using the exact language. He knows what he has. There's no subterfuge. There's no using euphemisms. It's like clear language. This is what I have. This is what happens. So first of all, the clarity and understanding what the illness is or what the challenge is on their level, being very clear. That would be first of all. The second thing is that in the book, the child kind of like asks his questions, but what he's afraid about. Like, you know, what will happen if the kids see my scar at school? Well, how am I going to only hear with only one ear? With only one ear? How am I going to hear with only one ear? You know, so the ability for a child to express their fears, they're not necessarily good answers, but for that, a child can say what they're afraid of. And sometimes that's really just enough. And then there's a third one, for example, that a child can even express his feelings about Hashem. It's like, I don't see Hashem helping. Like he goes, I don't see Hashem's helpers over here. And his father answers, you know, Hashem is here, even though you don't always see it. And again, you know, being able to let children of all ages to be able to express that and not to be afraid, oh my, you know, because the truth is, like, our Yiddishkeit and Hashem is not so superficial and flimsy that a little push will push Hashem over. It's like Hashem really can handle those questions. He's heard them for 5,000 years plus. Your 10-year-old kid's question is not going to throw him over. So I think there's also, you know, that piece. And then most importantly, the mindfulness that comes through in the book. Here you have a child that is extremely attuned to his emotions. He's like the paper menchies, we call Hilly Pilly Shimmy and Shmaya, the paper menchies, they're imagined as cutouts that come alive. So in a sense, like they, like, which means here you have a child that's extremely mindful that he's feeling sad and mad and scared. And then he's able to specifically address all these emotions in a way that he can cope. So I think it's also like allowing children to verbalize what they're feeling, what they're thinking, and throughout the book, that kind of like comes out. I don't like do it in a heavy-handed way. It's in a very lighthearted way. But as a therapist, like, we kind of like have that. You know, I definitely put that in, you know, to be able to help children to identify with that and be able to do it on their own as well.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your experience. Thank you for talking about the book. I'll make sure that our show notes and the introduction will have some information in case listeners are interested in exploring the book and where to buy it. And thank you again for the beautiful conversation.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was my honor and pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the JOMA podcast. We welcome your feedback and ideas for future episodes. Send us an email at health@joma.org. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform.